Alright, the recording is on.
Okay. So where are these being posted, Anya?
They will go to the PPS webpage.
Okay, and what goes there? Are printed materials as well as the recording?
Yeah, it goes both, but with the printed material, we have to be careful that we don't copy and paste anything out of the articles.
Yeah.
So all the nicely pasted tables and figures, we actually have to remove them before
we... Well, the tables that I include are rarely the tables from the article, and so the tables included for this month, for example, were tables that I made.
Oh, okay, good. That's perfect.
Yeah. And then who can access them on the PPS page? Only PPS members, or is it open to the public?
So it's my understanding that you have to be a PPS member, but I can ask again about that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, is that okay with you? If people are not okay with that, we don't have to do that.
No, I was just curious. I was just asking questions. I don't have strong
people
together. I just like not doing the blog anymore.
Yeah, that must have been a lot of work, huh?
It was. But I have heard complaints from people that I don't do it anymore, so I wanted to know where I could redirect them for these materials, and I wanted to be able to tell them whether or not they had to be a member of the organization to access them.
Yeah, let me ask again, but I think that was the case.
Okay.
But anyway, yeah, people listen to that. So it was frustrating, absolutely.
How are things in Rochester?
Snowy.
Is it really?
Light. Oh, yeah. We got actually a snowstorm.
Oh, really?
Hmm. And as usual, we had our Christmas party on Saturday, and I think it happens almost every year. It starts snowing in the morning of the Christmas
party. No kidding.
Party. Yeah.
Well, that's too bad.
I know. So, I mean, people still come, but...
Yeah.
Turnout definitely is lower because, I mean, it's some people come from far and...
Yep, I get it.
Yeah. And, but it looks beautiful.
Yeah, I love that.
But Michigan must get snow, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do. We've had some snow already, but we had a particularly warm weekend, so all the snow went away. I was just wondering if that warming trend extended all the way to Minnesota. I'll conclude that it did not.
Well, not last weekend, no. But we did have some nice days.
Good.
Yeah. No, things are going good. Yeah,
good.
Nice and busy, so that's great.
I'm sitting in a room that so far has Christine Konopka in it, Kenny Hughes, who was last year's fellow, who's doing a SurgePath fellowship this year, and KJ, who's this year's fellow, who will be presenting the second discussion article.
And very nice.
Michigan, it's 9:15. I think it's 8:15 where you are. Is anyone else on the call other than Anya in Michigan?
Amir Lackstein.
Hi, Amir. More Michigan.
Hey. Yes, I'm in Michigan.
And Tao Wong, another faculty member here, just entered the room, as did Stefan Sturer, who's a visitor from Hamburg.
Oh,
and Amir on the line.
German?
So he's a very Michigan. Oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure he speaks German. Stefan, say something in German.
Hallo da.
Oh, schön.
He's tried to teach me to say that, but I don't know how yet. Well, why don't we get started? We picked four articles for discussion. The first is by Alberto Marchewski, and addresses Ki-67 labeling in well-differentiated neuroendocrine neoplasms of the lung. I wanted to discuss this because KI-67 is always a part of the conversation with any oncologist these days, and I've been a great admirer of Alberto's work on this topic, and he has demonstrated pretty convincingly that KI-67 doesn't add a lot of value to the WHO classification scheme. So I read this article hopeful that he would prove once and for all that we need not do this stain, and I was sadly disappointed. He had several goals with this study. He first wanted to learn whether the disparate language used in pulmonary neuroendocrine neoplasms compared to the GI tract and pancreas was a problem for our oncology colleagues, and he wanted to assess their own view of the value of KI-67 labeling index in lung neoplasms. He also wanted to understand whether there was a meaningful and potentially reproducible role for KI-67 labeling index in the risk stratification of typical carcinoid tumors of the lung. It's been pretty convincingly shown that there's no reproducible cutoff for separating what we've referred to historically as typical and atypical carcinoid tumors, although there's good evidence that KI-67 is a fairly good prognostic marker. It just doesn't outperform the histologic criteria. So he addressed these goals by doing a number of things. First, he did a survey, and he chose to survey 189 physicians who participated in the 2017 annual fall meeting of the North American Neuroendocrine Tumor Society. And I summarized his questions. You can see his questions in table one. So I'll read from his table, which is kind of the complete version. And these aren't exactly open-ended questions, and I think he kind of got the responses you would predict. Yeah, number one, do you find the information provided by the KI-67 proliferative index useful for selecting therapy in patients with pulmonary carcinoid tumors? Number two, do you find the information provided by the KI-67 proliferative index useful for informing patients with pulmonary carcinoid tumors about their prognosis? Number three, if you use the information provided by the proliferative index in your decision process, what value do you consider significant as a poor prognostic feature that may require more aggressive therapy? Number four, pathologists use different criteria and terminology for the diagnosis of low-grade/intermediate-grade neuroendocrine tumors arising in different locations. Does this variability create problems in your practice? And number five, is it important for the selection of therapy in patients with a metastatic neuroendocrine tumor of unknown origin to determine the site of origin? I know you're on the edge of your seats to know how they responded to these questions, but we'll get to that in a minute. The second thing he did, and he really did three things. So he did a survey of oncologists, and then he did a systematic evidence-based review of relevant literature. His search strategy was in PubMed, and it was simple. He combined KI-67 with the word carcinoid, with the word lung neoplasms, and limited his search to English language papers with at least 10 patients. They did kind of a simple review of the papers. They recorded the number of patients included, their method for calculating the KI-67 proliferative index, and any cutoffs significantly associated with prognosis, how were they expressed and how were they measured. In addition, he looked at a retrospective cohort of 256 consecutive typical and atypical carcinoids collected at his own institution that had available KI-67 proliferative indices, I think from the reports. He didn't redo the work. And then to that cohort in particular, he separated tumors into three categories, basically analogous to the grade 1 through 3 well-differentiated neuroendocrine neoplasms of the pancreas and gut. A were typical carcinoids with a KI-67 labeling index of less than 5%. Group B were typical carcinoid tumors with KI-67 labeling indexes of 5% or more, and group C were atypical carcinoid tumors. So that was the work that he did. So what did he discover? He got a reasonable response rate to his survey, a little better than 17%, which as surveys goes isn't bad. If you ask oncologists, is KI-67 important, 100% said yes. I'm shocked. If you ask them, is it useful for talking to your patients about prognosis, a little over 80% said yes. When you ask them what cutoff you view as kind of the poor prognostic cutoff, they said anything over 10% is affiliated with a more guarded prognosis and is a rationale for adjuvant therapy. 91% actually use that cutoff. And Alberto points out in his discussion, there isn't a single paper in the literature that makes sense of that cutoff. So it's just one of those urban legends that has now become, quote, standard practice, close quotes. If you ask oncologists, is our terminology problematic, only two-thirds said yes, which I was surprised at. I thought it'd be higher. And if you ask, is it important for you to know the site of origin when you see metastatic neuroendocrine tumor of unknown primary site, 80% said yes. So I don't think there were a lot of surprises in the survey. It certainly suggests that we have an opportunity to do better for the providers for whom this information is important. He said they captured 42 papers using their simple search algorithm, but they reduced it to 11 that he said provided best available evidence. So we don't really know why the other 31 papers were out, but he's a smart guy, I trust his judgment. And they kind of added those to his retrospective cohort, but they couldn't do that kind of on a one-to-one basis. The retrospective cohort was interesting. They had 225 typical carcinoid tumors using WHO criteria. Of those, the majority, 187, were type A tumors, meaning tumors with a Ki-67 labeling index of less than 5%. 38 were type B tumors, meaning typical carcinoid tumors with a proliferation index of 5% or more, and there were 31 atypical carcinoid tumors. So their real interest was whether there's a difference between A and B. We know there's a difference between typical and atypical carcinoid tumors. In terms of the demographics, there was no difference in the sex distribution, median age of diagnosis, or median tumor size if you compared group A to group B under the typical carcinoid banner. He was interested in what technique was used in the papers. In the discussion, he said the hotspot manual approach was the most common, but actually, if you look at the 11 papers, that's not really true. Four of the 11 used a random image analysis, and three more used random selection of sites. Two were manual, one was both manual and image analysis. So randomly chosen fields was actually more common than looking at hotspots. The hotspot manual technique was used by three of the 11 papers. One more paper used hotspots, but used both manual and image analysis. So kind of the approach is all over the map. But the key point is that there was significantly worse prognosis in group B and C patients, as illustrated in his figure two. And in figure three, he shows that if you compare group A and group B patients, group A patients had significantly longer progression-free survival. There was also a trend toward a higher percentage of tumor recurrence in group B and a trend toward shorter mean times to recurrence in the group B patients, but those differences were not statistically significant in this cohort. So, to my disappointment, the take-home message seemed to me that there's now no getting around it. You kind of have to do Ki-67 on all well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumors of the lung. And I suspect that means that our terminology will change with the next iteration of the WHO. They also mentioned in the discussion that molecular testing may well be on the horizon, but that really had nothing to do with the data that they collected. So that's my take on this paper. Any comments, discussion, thoughts? Are you routinely doing them?
No, we sometimes get asked to do it, and then we do it just by counting. But I'm really wondering if one should actually look into these different techniques, which Alberto nicely points out here. I mean, you can do it by hotspot, by random, by DIA. I mean, what have you, but if they really want to put it in the WHO, they should probably come down to one of them.
Yes, and I think he was just describing what's in the literature. I don't know that he's advocating for one, although in all of his papers he's used an automated image analysis technique applied to randomly chosen fields. So that's what he uses, although I don't recall that he said anything to defend that technique over any other. I don't know that it's all that standardized in the gut and the pancreas, is it?
It is.
Is it?
Yeah. In the pancreas, you have to count 1,000 cells.
Yeah, but how you count them? You don't have to use, you can do that manually or using image analysis?
We do both, actually.
You do both?
Yeah.
But is there a like a guideline that says you should use both?
I guess that's in the guideline, actually, to do a printout of a tumor portion with at least a couple cells.
Okay.
As I know it from the GI team, actually.
Okay. Yeah. So you're absolutely right, Anya. I don't think he makes a recommendation, but we would kind of need one if we were going to standardize that behavior.
Yeah.
Any other? And by the way, we do the same thing you do. We do not routinely do them. We do them when we're asked. And to be honest, I mean, the vast majority of these are surgical problems, and we don't get asked until an oncologist is involved. And I don't think oncologists get involved in the care of at least typical carcinoid patients until they have an unanticipated recurrence or present with an unanticipated advanced stage lesion. So I think for us, we get asked when there's an oncologist involved, and I think for many of these patients, it's a surgical disease. Well, in the interest of time, why don't we go on to the second paper? Senior author is our own Marie-Christine Aubrey. This will be presented by J.J., our fellow. J.J.?
Yeah. Hi. I'm the current thoracic fellow here. My name is Jianjing, J.J. So is the author here, Dr. Aubrey?
I don't know. Marie-Christine, are you on the line? No, so you can say whatever you want.
Okay, great. So, so the paper talk about comparing the PD-L1 test in the EBUS aspiration specimen and with the final resected lung cancer specimen. And this is, when Jeff asked me to pick a paper, this is very interesting to me because nowadays there's a lot of cytology specimens as mentioned in the paper, which came, especially the staging one, came out as the only specimen before you have the, you know, final resection. So you're getting, this is a, you want to get the predictive value from this small specimen. So the paper talk about the PD-L1 test to establish the PD-L1 test all the sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, negative predictive value, and compare with the resection to see how the concordance is. What that means is if we get EBUS cytology specimen, we will use that for the PD-L1 test to see whether the value can be trusted for the treatment of the patient. So this is the purpose. Okay, the method is a retrospective cohort study. To pick up the patient who have been underwent the EBUS bronchial needle aspiration, and also the patient also have final surgical resection, so we can compare with the PD-1 test effect. So the way we pick up, and then we just, you know, pick up the patient, and the first one we need to know the cellularity, so just semi-quantitative assessment of cell block cellularity. And the second is to know what the category, you know, you the cut point you want to know, what's the, what do you call the positive one, which is at least a moderate or at least a moderate membrane staining, you call it positive. And the expression level and the zero, less than 1% or 1% to, in the 50, in 5% increment. And the cut point is over 1% or over 50%, which is exactly the, you know, FDA approved, like, companion diagnosed assay required predict the, treatment according whether you, negative, less than 1%, or you intermediate, like 1% to 50%, or over 50%.
And those cutoffs apply just to pembrolizumab, right? So,
yeah.
So it's a companion diagnostic for that,
yeah,
drug only.
Yeah, that is very good, because this is also used two clonal antibody here is 2-2-C3, which is exactly the companion diagnostic requirement. The platform, antibody platform, the same thing. Okay, the result. So here we have totally 61 patients. These patients are, you know, pick up, you have EBUS specimen, you have final resection to compare. And among these patients, adenocarcinoma is 64%, squamous cell carcinoma is 21%, large cell is 2%. And also you have compared the new adjuvant therapy, because the reason to showing that is because previous study have shown the new adjuvant therapy changes the PD-L1 expression. So this is the very good data to select here. Also the days from the e-birth to the surgery, and also another demo, other clinical data to showing all these variants does not affect our testing here. So, okay, we have the major point here, the result here. So 32 or 52% is negative in both. 14 cases, 23% is over 1%, and 15 cases or 25% is over 50% of the in the surgical specimen. Then have a list table here. You clearly compare two cut points. For PD-L1 over 1%, you have a positive tested on the EBUS, and you have a 21 positive in the final resection, and none of them showing negative, which means this is 100% specificity or 100% positive predictive value. However, if you have EBUS negative, there's 8 cases in the test is negative. In the negative, there's 8 cases showing in the positive, but there's a 32% showing the negative, which means you have 8 cases is a false negative, right? 8 cases false negative. So the sensitivity is 72%. And the negative predictive value is 80%. So the concordance in this cut value is 87%. Okay, come to the next cut value is over 50%. So if you have EBUS, testing on the EBUS specimen is totally is 10, and you actually, during the 10, the only 7 is truly positive in the tumor in the resection, and 3 of them is negative in the final resection. So for the EBUS tested, it's totally like 51 cases is negative in the EBUS, and 8 of them is truly positive in the final resection, and 43 is negative in the final resection. So what that means, summarizes, the sensitivity is 47% in this cutoff, and specificity is 93, still good, and the positive predictive value is 70%, and negative predictive value is 84%, concordance is 82%. Okay. So, the final result is no significant difference for the treatment, like whether your treatment does not affect the test result. So the take home point here is from EBUS is a reliable tool to predict the PD-L1 expression for the concordance as we can see here. However, if we notice there's like cut value as 50%, the sensitivity is relatively low, only 47. That means is like if you have a negative result, you may consider whether that's truly negative or not, because the sensitivity in over 50% is relatively low. And the reason for that is we have discussed in the paper is because maybe that's because the small biopsy from the small aspiration, probably that due to the intratumoral heterogeneity is always a problem. A second thing is a lower cellularity associated with false negative result. As we mentioned in the table as well, if your PD-L1 less than 30% in the resected specimen, there's 85 of 8 is less than 1,000 cell high power field or 1,000 cell in the cell block, which means low cellularity is also associated with false negative case. This is actually another problem generally met in the aspiration is sampling error. It's sampling error. Okay. I have good discovery here. I think this is a big problem because the EBUS aspiration depends on your practice, whether you have a rapid onset evaluation, what is your experience of performer, and what is your needle size. It's all mentioned in the discussion. It's all determine your cellularity. And also, I think the cellularity, not in this antibody 2233, but in the SP142, is I think people generally require like cell block. You need like over 100 variable tumor cell. So in our study here, if you look at the tape, I think in the paper, actually I summarized here. So there's like if you have like for the one cut point. For like, if you're like 1%, see all the false negative cases, all the false negative cases. If you look at here, there's a lymph node. There's like for the false negative case, cut point of one, there's total 6 cases are less than 100 variable cell, right? Four cases less than 100 variable cell. For the 50 over 50 cutoff, there's totally 3 cases in the 4 false negative cases is less than 100 like variable cell. What that means is this is actually a problem, like whether your cell block have good cellularity to do the experiment. I mean, if this is more clear, if we getting more cellularity in the cell block, at least from data here, you probably have a more precise predictive value. Okay.
Okay. Any questions or comments? I'm curious, if at Mayo, if you have a PD-L1 result on an EBIS, and the patient goes to resection, and maybe that doesn't really happen, but do you redo the test on the resection?
Well, I don't know, because we only do it at the request of the clinician.
Yeah, okay. That's
so I'm not sure if they re-request that. But I was wondering, I mean, for these cell blocks, yeah, I always tell them if it's negative, it might not be reliable. If it's positive,
right.
I think
then
it's good.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if we would need a certain cutoff to even do the PD-L1 on the EBA. So meaning if you have less than 100 cells, viable tumor cells, you probably shouldn't even report it.
Yeah, that's probably right. Yeah, I'm curious, and I don't even know what it means to say that the EBIS is a false positive result. I mean, positive is positive, and just because it's negative in the resection doesn't mean it was negative in the EBIS. You know what I mean? So given what we know about the heterogeneity of expression, like would that patient be a candidate for pembrolizumab or not? And my guess is yes.
Yep.
Right? I mean, if any sample gives you the result you need, and to me this kind of speaks to whether this makes any sense at all for the use of pembrolizumab or any other drugs. Many of the other drugs aren't required to have this sort of testing to make a decision of whether to use it or not. So kind of interesting. I wish Marie-Christine was on the line so she could tell us what we didn't pick up in the paper, but I thought it was a good paper. I'm sure she would agree with that. Any other comments or questions?
Hi, it's Margaret here. Hi, there's a paper by Gilbert Bigras that I can't remember when it was published, but quite recently, and he looked at he did a simulated thing, and he took an area of tumor with only 100 cells, and he showed the very high incidence of false positives and some false negatives and some false positives, and he worked out that you need at least 1 millimeter squared of viable tumor to get a decent result with testing.
Yeah, that's great.
So yeah, that's tumor altogether, obviously, you know, in the sample. So.
And I'm not sure how to translate that to EBIS cellularity because they're not the same, but it makes the same point that you need kind of a minimum amount of tumor to make a reliable prediction. I know we have one oncologist here who gets very upset if two different laboratories disagree on the 1% cut point, but honestly, the likelihood of agreeing with each other consistently on a 1% cut point for something that also stains macrophages and little samples from the lung, I think is a pipe dream.
Right.
Okay, let's go on to the next one. I debated whether I wanted to do this paper because the technology is well beyond my grasp, but I think the principles are pretty interesting, and I think they're understandable. I think the authors do a pretty good job of making them understandable to someone with limited intellectual capacity like me. But what they were really interested in was studying intertumor heterogeneity at a molecular level in treatment-naive advanced stage lung cancer. Of course, intertumor heterogeneity has been of great interest as molecular signatures drive more and more therapeutic decision-making, but that's hard to study in treatment-naive tumors. So they used tumor samples from 5 autopsied lung cancer patients. 2 of them were adenocarcinomas, 2 were squamous cell carcinomas, and 1 was a small cell carcinoma. And none of these patients received systemic treatment prior to death for a variety of reasons. They extracted RNA. They basically used an Illumina NGS platform, and they provided some language to comfort us that their results were reliable. They used sequencing reads mapped against various libraries and databases. They also had a method for detecting gene fusions. They also did immunohistochemistry for PD-L1. They also had expression data for PD-L1. And they constructed these clever phylogenetic trees for multiple lesions in each patient that I've kind of reduced to a tabular form that's modified from the table they provided, but the figures in the paper are I think, informative. Their five patients were three men and two women. They were elderly. The youngest was 77. The oldest was 96. I don't know how that might have biased the results. There were 4 to 9 lesions per patient, including 3 who had involvement of extrathoracic sites. It turns out that smoking status was an important part of their conversation, so they let us know that of the 2 patients with adenocarcinoma, one was an ever smoker, one was a smoker. Both patients with squamous cell carcinoma were smokers, one of which was a heavy smoker, which they defined as at least 50 pack years of exposure, and their single patient with small cell lung carcinoma was a heavy smoker. The first thing they did, which I think is kind of comforting, was that in global unsupervised clustering of their expression data, they showed that lesions from each patient clustered together, and actually the tumor types clustered together, which kind of is validating that because that makes sense, right? And if they didn't cluster together with the same patient, you'd wonder what the biostatistics was accomplishing in the first place. But all of that is shown nicely in their figure one. So at least at a global level, expression data can identify patients across tumor sites. They were very interested in pathway analysis in these patients, and they showed that there were 27 to 98 dysregulated pathways in each patient, adding up all of their tumor sites. What was interesting was that the dysregulated pathways were conserved across sites for 52 pathways from the never smoker, 15 and 35 pathways in the non-heavy smokers, and in only one and for only 1 and 5 pathways in the heavy smokers, speaking to the degree of heterogeneity in heavy smokers is different from the level of heterogeneity in non-smokers and less heavy smokers. In all patients, primary lesions were always distinct from the mets, despite conservation of certain dysregulated pathways across sites. It was interesting that metastatic lesions often clustered based on site. So lymph node mets clustered with other lymph node mets, mets to the lung and pleura clustered with other mets to lung and pleura, and mets to extrathoracic sites like the adrenal gland or bone clustered with mets to other extrathoracic sites. And in fact, the metastatic sites were distinct in terms of the pathway analysis in showing consistent upregulation of cell proliferation pathways and downregulation of immune-related pathways compared to the primary sites. And in fact, the most immune-regulated pathway downregulation was seen with pleural mets. Suggest that the pleura is some sort of immune haven for metastases. Their mutational analysis was similar in that it showed a distinct mutational profile in the primary compared to mets. They used the terms trunk and metastatic trunk mutations. Trunk were mutations that were conserved across all sites. So this is what we really want to know about, right? This is if you identify what you believe is a driver in a biopsy of one lesion, what is the likelihood that it's a driver across all lesions?
Yeah.
And it turns out that if you look at the table, trunk mutations were conserved across multiple sites in most patients, but notice that the lowest number was in a heavy smoker. Again, speaking to the conclusion they draw that there is greater intertumor heterogeneity in heavy smokers, which in the discussion they say kind of lines up with the fact that smoking-related tumors tend to show a higher mutational burden, but if you look at their total number of mutations, it's hard to draw that conclusion, but it's also hard to know how to sort out total mutations because that's total mutations across multiple sites, so it doesn't really easily flow from their numbers. Metastatic trunk mutations are mutations that were present in all of the Mets, so preserved across all Mets. That's the trunk part, but not seen in the primary. And there were metastatic trunk mutations at a fairly high rate, again, except in the heavy smoker with a squamous cell carcinoma. So, and their PD-L1 data, I think, fits nicely with the previous conversation. They saw no correlations between mutation burden and PD-L1 expression, but their PD-L expression was highly variable across sites. And in fact, in their adenocarcinoma from their never smoker, which was positive at a level of 60%, so a high positive that would qualify her for first-line therapy with pembrolizumab, that was seen in the primary, and all of her Mets were negative, not only by immunohistochemistry, but also in the RNA expression data. So, again, I think making the value of immunohistochemistry as a discriminator for selecting patients for treatment something of somewhat dubious value, but it also speaks to the common observation that patients who have multiple tumor sites don't always respond the same in each site, and this study really, I think, adds to what's already known about the heterogeneity that may account for those observations. So their take-home messages were that metastatic lesions can be used as surrogates for the primary, at least at the level of global gene expression patterns, but there is significant intertumor heterogeneity in terms of dysregulated pathways and somatic mutations and variable, and it seems to correlate with smoking status. It's higher in heavy smokers. Mets have upregulated cell proliferation and downregulated immune-related pathways that may promote their metastatic potential and adaptation to foreign microenvironments. And again, PD-L1 expression is highly variable across sites, which, to my way of thinking, complicates an already complicated story when it comes to PD-L1. So that's a simplistic view of a complicated study using what I think were legitimate and likely reproducible techniques. Any questions or comments, especially from those who understand these things more than I do? No?
I have a thought or comment, not so much a question, but maybe you can tell me what you think based on reading this paper. As part of our search path officer duties here, we're often asked to choose a piece of tumor to send a slide to send for molecular testing for which a variety of tests are done. And when the request is non-specific, in other words, it doesn't say you must choose the primary, I automatically, for myself, I choose a metastasis instead of the primary. Would that be supported by this paper?
I think yes. I think they would say yes. I think they would say that, you know, there's good evidence that these trunk mutations are drivers and they're conserved across multiple sites. I think the significance of the inter-tumor heterogeneity in terms of treatment selection is unknown. So I think they would say yes, that makes sense.
Cool. Thank you.
Our last paper, for which we have 10 minutes, interested me because all of us devote time and energy to tumor boards. At least I think we do. Does everybody do tumor boards?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And so this, I wanted to read this paper to understand whether that's time well spent from a patient perspective. I mean, I think there are lots of things we could say kind of anecdotally about why we think it has value, but this paper wanted to study that. And the title of the paper is Does Presentation at Multidisciplinary Team Meetings Improve Lung Cancer Survival? Findings from a consecutive cohort study that was actually done in an Australian hospital. In their introduction, they survey the literature and say that basically there's no high-level evidence about the value of tumor boards because that's a hard thing to get given the way that most tumor boards are done and the way the data is collected and archived. So they wanted to take another run at assessing the relationship, if any, between being presented at a multidisciplinary team meeting and outcome. And they did that by doing, a post hoc analysis of prospectively collected data in a consecutive cohort of lung cancer patients who were registered in their Australian Institutional Cancer Registry and had tissue diagnoses between the 1st of January 2006 and the end of 2012. And it's important to know that they started their tumor board in 2006. So this is kind of data collected over the life of their tumor board through 2012. They collected survival data through the 23rd of May 2014, and so their follow-up data was censored on that time frame. They compared survival after diagnosis, which was their primary aim, but they also wanted to understand any demographic differences between patients who were presented and patients who weren't presented. And in terms of who was selected for presentation, that was not standardized, as I suspect is the case in most institutions, although I don't know that. Patients were referred to their tumor board at the discretion of treating clinicians, and they were referred at various points in their care. Could be a diagnosis, could be after failed therapy, so that this was, it's really not standardized. And so far as I know, it's not standardized in our own institution. I think our patients are also referred to the tumor board at the discretion of treating clinicians. So what did they learn? They had a total of 1,197 cases over the time period of the study, and of those, about one in four was referred to their multidisciplinary team meeting, which I'll probably continue referring to as tumor board because it just is easier. What were the differences between the patient populations? I've summarized it in a table, which is not the table in the paper, so there's no copyright issue here. MDT patients were younger. They tended to have earlier stage disease, and their stage was more likely to be known, which makes sense to me. I mean, at our tumor board, you don't get to leave the room until you agree on what the stage is. And they had a better performance status on average. So the ECOG status, 0 to 1, is good performance. 60% of the patients presented at their MDT were 0 or 1, and only 32% of those who were not presented at their tumor board. The rate of referral, not surprisingly, I would say, increased from 2006, which was their first year. In that year, 19% of their patients were referred. At the end of their data collection period, 2012, it was 34%, but actually that had dropped compared to 2010 and 2011. It peaked in 2011 at 52%. There was no difference in gender distribution or the distribution of non-small cell and small cell lung carcinomas between the two groups, although they pointed out that the proportion of non-small cell lung carcinomas presented was higher than the proportion of small cell lung carcinoma patients presented. So 30% of their non-small cell lung carcinoma patients make it to tumor board compared to 21% of their small cell lung carcinoma cases. When they did multivariate analysis adjusted for age, sex, performance status, pathology stage, and year of diagnosis, it turns out that presentation at tumor board was associated with improved survival at 5 years at a statistically significant rate, and that's demonstrated in the figure included in my summary, which was stolen from their paper. So, you know, in answer to their questions, does it improve lung cancer survival? Their data would suggest the answer to that question is yes, which at least makes it feel like when you're going to tumor board, you're doing a noble, worthwhile thing. There was no significant difference in the rates of referral to palliative care for stage four patients, although the median time to referral was shorter for non-MDT patients, 26 days versus almost 70 days, which for a patient with stage four lung cancer is not insignificant. And it really speaks to the fact that the downside to tumor boards is if you use that as the kind of inflection point for a plan of care, the patient waits longer than patients who don't go to tumor board. So what are the take-home messages that I think come through their discussion? They acknowledge that their data is not perfect either. But despite the methodological vulnerabilities in terms of lack of standardization for MDT referral and their available data sources, MDT presentation may be an independent, clinically significant component of lung cancer care, adding fuel to the notion that this may be an acceptable standard of care. But if it's an acceptable standard of care, I think you have to be careful, because if that's a standard, it's pretty hard to live with the fact that three-fourths of patients never get there. So whatever your own feelings about the work entailed, I think it's important work that is almost certainly here to stay, at least in peer cancer treatment centers. Any comments, questions,
nasty remarks? It's actually pretty encouraging.
It is, isn't it? I thought it was.
Yeah.
I have a tumor board this week, and I think I'm going to have a better attitude.
So how often do they do tumor boards? Ours is every week. So
yeah,
we see quite a few.
Yeah, I bet.
We have 3 to 4 a day. We have a thorax board, a lung cancer board, a thorax tumor board, an IBD board. We have an ILD board. We have a heme board. We have everything in boards.
And yeah, we've got
we
tons of boards.
The patient is three times at the same at another board with the same disease. So that's kind of weird, actually, in Germany, in my opinion.
Well, there's so much that's weird in Germany that, I mean, where do we start? I think we, too, and I suspect it's true at Mayo and other institutions represented on the call, we have lots and lots of tumor boards. But in terms of pulmonary diseases, ours is a thoracic oncology conference, and it's really defined by our thoracic surgeons. So our thoracic oncology tumor board is all lung cancers, all mediastinal tumors, all pleural tumors, and all esophageal tumors because they do the esophagectomy. So one of the conflicts we have in our practice is who should do the thoracic oncology tumor board. The GI pathologists say not us. The cytologists say not us. The pulmonary pathologists say, well, it's clearly us, but it's you guys too. So it's a shared team sport. But they're long tumor boards, right? We do ours weekly as well, Anya, and, man, that can be a ton of patients.
Yeah. But for us, it's limit for an hour, so they have to be done within the hour. But I know they actually do it every day, but the pathologist doesn't have to come every day. We only come on Mondays. But they have the radiologist, and every day, I think, except for one of the days in the week, they meet at lunchtime or at 1 with the radiologist and oncologist and so on, and go over tumor board cases, but still not over everyone.
No kidding.
Yeah?
Because of the lot of tumor boards we have, we bought the notebooks for every attendee to attend via video conference to these tumor boards, which actually works that way that we just open the notebook and we click onto this video conference and do our routine work while they do our tumor board, and we're actually never physically or visually attended at these tumor boards.
So lots of tumor boards. Well, there's evidence to believe that that work matters. Our clock in Michigan says 9:58, so we're down to the last 2 minutes. A fair number of articles for notation. I don't know that any of them are worthy of special mention. I think the titles are fairly self-explanatory. There's more stuff on PD-L1, which I don't think adds a lot of value to what's already been said about PD-L1. There is a nice paper about pleural mesotheliomas showing that microsatellite instability is not really a common pathway in these tumors. In fact, they didn't see an MSI high phenotype in any of their pleural mesotheliomas, so at least we don't have to start doing that, or at least there's little rationale for it. There's a nice summary paper, Andy Churg, first author, that gives the highlights of the 14th International Mesothelioma Interest Group meeting. So what were the things they highlighted? They highlighted the use of an immunostain for MTAP in combination with BAP1, and in one case, a 117-gene panel to improve the sensitivity for distinguishing meso from non-neoplastic mesothelial proliferations. They pointed out that pathologists don't agree much with one another when it comes to distinguishing biphasic mesos, which is not a surprise. They showed that transitional mesos behave like sarcomatoid mesos, which I think has been shown before. And actually, they make the point that our histological distinctions, however relevant to prognosis, are somewhat artificial if you look at the genetic continuum of these neoplasms. And they give the criteria for recognizing mesothelioma in situ. So something that Andy has been a bit cynical about for years when he presents it, at least in the talks that I attend, and now appears to be a thing, which is frightening to me. So that's it. It's 10 o'clock here. Thanks for joining. If there are any things we didn't get to that you wish we had, you're welcome to send an email.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.